You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good afternoon and welcome everyone, and thank you for joining us here today for A Brown Bag, where we're going to be focusing on outreach for the war crimes tribunals that have been set up around the world and also on victim participation in those tribunals as well. As a quick introduction, my name is Tracy Gerd. I have been working with the International Justice Program of the Open Society Justice Initiative for the last 6 years, and I'm just transitioning over into a new advocacy position. But part of my work with the International Justice Program has been to collaborate, or have the good fortune of collaborating with Eric Stover, who is here with us today. So Eric is an OSI fellow. He's been with us for a year, and he's also the faculty director of the Human Rights Center of UC Berkeley. And so he and I have been working on an outreach project together, which I'm going to speak a little bit about today. And then Eric is also going to be speaking about the victim participation research that he's been doing also during his fellowship. So the lovely thing about moderating is that I don't have to cut myself off when I'm speaking, but I'm going to try and keep my remarks fairly brief. But I want to talk today, first of all, about outreach. So when the British supermodel Naomi Campbell testified in the trial of a former Liberian president, Charles Taylor, about a month ago, the international spotlight shifted, if only for a moment, a fleeting few moments, to the tiny West African nation of Sierra Leone, who endured a horrific war for over a decade that started in 1991. And suddenly, journalists from around the world were starting to ask, so who is this Charles Taylor? And what has he got to do with these horrendous rapes, these mass killings, these amputations of people's limbs that were conducted by marauding rebels in a neighboring country? And how is he mixed up with blood diamonds, celebrities, and supermodels anyway? So as we in the Western world were starting to find out the answers to this, the idea that Charles Taylor allegedly supported these rebels as they wreaked mayhem through Sierra Leone during the war, and that he apparently gave them weapons to help support their and perpetrate their crimes in exchange for blood diamonds from Sierra Leone. The people who were most affected by these crimes that were being litigated half a world away had no access to televisions, had no access to radios, who had no access to newspapers to know what was going on in the trial. So I happened to be in Sierra Leone just a few days before Naomi Campbell actually turned up to testify. And I was actually in the diamond-rich area of Kono, where a lot of the crimes were taking place. This is very fancy, but I'll try and show you. So Kono is over here in the eastern region of Sierra Leone. And there people were very, very isolated. They had no services. The roads were very bad. You'll see it in a moment. And people remained largely isolated from the news. So the way that they got information about the trial really came through one man, a former military policeman called Isaiah Soluku, who made his way by taxi or by motorcycle around the very potholed roads in the Kono district and talked to people about the trial. So I actually caught up with him in a tiny little village called Small Sefadu, which was right in the middle of the diamond mining area in Sierra Leone, and a stronghold for the rebel forces during the war. And I just wanted to show you just a little bit so you can see exactly what we're dealing with here. So you're really in for a treat of cinematic excellence here. What I wanted to show you is because the rebels were based there, a lot of the buildings in the town were burnt down by the rebels. So Isaiah told me it was because when the rebels wanted light in the evenings, they would just set fire to people's houses and buildings, and this would be what was left. So you're seeing, you know, some of the houses are being rebuilt, but you know, really there's quite a lot of devastation there. So as you can, I'm not solely to blame for this poor camera shoot. We're actually on very potholed roads here, so there's no services. It's a very, very remote area. more burnt out buildings. Here's the last one I'll show you, just so you get a sense of where people are at over here. Okay. So after landing in small Sepadu, which you just saw, we went and spoke to the village chief. He gave out his blessing for us to go and speak to people in the community. So we made our way over to a youth group. There were about 20 young men who were sitting around on a veranda chatting. And we went up to speak about the trial with them. And so after the conversation got going for a while, I said to them, you know, do you know this Naomi Campbell is about to turn up in a few days, you know, to testify in the trial, and it's such a big deal where I came from. I come from, you know, so what do you think about it? They looked at me blankly. Who is Naomi Campbell? So, you know, for all the fuss, they were actually very, very interested in what the reasons were as to why this woman was turning up. You know, the idea that there was this beautiful woman that was allegedly given diamonds, these blood diamonds, potentially, according to prosecutors, it could have come from the area where they were based, at a star-studded dinner hosted by Nelson Mandela back in 1997 in South Africa. And this was meant to show that he was in possession of diamonds at a time on a trip where prosecutors say that he was exchanging them for weapons. But back in small Sepadu, almost immediately, the young men became very, very animated about this issue. So some of them jumped up to take the role of the prosecutor and were saying, you know, of course that shows that Taylor is responsible for the crimes that happened to us. There was forced labor in the mines. We saw Liberian rebels here. Of course he's responsible. Other young men jumped up and said, no, leave him out of this. This is solely the responsibility of our Sierra Leonean brothers, and that's where the accountability should remain. But this kind of dialogue really happens right around Sierra Leone, amongst the community. So outreach officers have been placed by the court in each of the 13 districts outside of Freetown. And they go around, they talk to school children, they hold town hall events, they screen testimony of the trial that's happening half a world away. And sometimes they actually bring the real prosecutors and real defense lawyers over so that people can ask questions about them, about what's going in the trial, criticize the trial, discuss the trial, analyze witness testimony, and generally know what's going on in terms of accountability. But this program in Sierra Leone actually was set up with no legal foundation. It's not to be found anywhere in the founding documents. It's not in the statute. And there certainly was no funding put towards outreach when the court was first set up. And indeed, this is basically the same for every tribunal that's been set up to deal with war crimes or crimes against humanity, with the exception being the Lebanon Tribunal, where outreach is actually in their statute. But yet, despite this lack of legal foundation, all of the tribunals, to some greater or lesser extent, conduct outreach activities themselves. And intuitively, the courts know that it's important to actually be speaking with the populations who are affected by the crimes being litigated. It's just much more difficult to articulate why exactly that is. And some of that comes from the lack of definition of what outreach is in the statute and also the very different context that that people are dealing with. So Eric and I tried to explore this issue actually when we conducted a workshop last month where we brought together all the outreach practitioners from different courts, so the Yugoslav Tribunal that was dealing with the Bosnian War, Special Court for Sierra Leone, so you've just seen that, the Extraordinary Chambers in Cambodia, which are dealing with the Khmer Rouge crimes of the 1970s, and also the International Criminal Court, of course, and as well as the Lebanon Tribunal. And this was the culmination of almost a year's work where we had traveled to different war-affected communities, we'd interviewed NGOs, academics, affected populations about outreach. We'd done literature surveys and we'd hosted a panel in Kampala at the review conference for the International Criminal Court earlier in the year. And what we hope to do from all of this is try and do basically the first serious study of what outreach is and why it's important for these tribunals. So when we got the outreach practitioners together about a month ago, we really wanted to go back to fundamentals with them. What is outreach? Why do you do it? Why is it important? Why can't these tribunals just set up, do their trials, you know, around the other side of the world, shut down, and as long as they're fair, why can't they be considered a success? So we were really trying to grapple with the answers to this, and it became very clear quite quickly that the outreach practitioners were also grappling with these questions and had come to very different answers as well. So what we found was basically that the outreach practitioners had held that there were basically three schools of thought about why you do outreach and why it's important. Summarized very crudely, I would put it as the marketing approach to outreach, the participatory democratic ideal of outreach, and then a transformational ideal of outreach. So to explain them a bit more, basically the first view that came out was very functional and pragmatic. What we're doing is basically PR by another name. We are simply trying to market or sell the tribunal to the population, and we are using the same tools as what we would if we were doing a marketing campaign. And when you think about this view of outreach, it's actually not that surprising when you think about how outreach actually started. So with the very first tribunal, the Yugoslav tribunal, after a number of years, one of the judges actually took a trip to the region from The Hague and discovered that in Serbia, not only did people not really know what the tribunal was doing, but didn't really like the tribunal. They didn't think it was doing a good job. And in fact, a lot of the supporters of the people who are on trial were actually creating these people as war heroes and seeing the tribunal as against the interests of the actual population. So the outreach, they came back, were shocked, decided to start an outreach program. And this started then in a very defensive mode. They wanted to establish legitimacy for the tribunal against this stem, to try and stem the tide of propaganda that was being perpetuated in the region. However, back in the workshop, the people who were there with us bristled at the notion that what they were doing was glorified PR. So some of them were saying, no, that's not actually correct. We have a different view of the agency of the people who are affected by war crimes trials. They are much more involved and should be much more engaged in this process, and we actually see this through the lens of a participatory democratic ideal. So basically the notion that these are public courts, they're funded by public monies, and so they should be accountable to and accessible by the populations that were affected by the crimes. So this notion then turns on its head the marketing idea of outreach, because it then starts with the population. They say, these are our clients, we need to know what they want to know about the tribunal, and we're going to organize how we talk about the tribunal, the discussions, the dialogues, according to what their information needs are, and to see them as very active agents in the process. So this has actually taken on an even more practical bent with the advent of tribunals like the International Criminal Court and the Extraordinary Chambers in Cambodia, where you have victim participation as part of the actual legal process. So victims there can actually put forward their views and concerns through legal representatives or even in some cases by themselves in the courtroom themselves. So outreach then takes on a different role. Not only is it a way to conduct a dialogue with the people in the communities most affected by the crimes, but it also has the practical function of informing victims of their right to participate and also to ensure that they get connected with people who can realize that right, so can fill out the forms and submit them to the trials themselves, the tribunals themselves. Now, for some in the workshop, however, this focus on the individual or even the communities and the relationship to the information coming out of the tribunals wasn't really enough to capture what outreach was all about. For them, outreach had to mean something bigger. And they would take a step back and they would look at these war crimes tribunals themselves and what they were set up to do. And to them, these tribunals were actually a symbol of transformation for their communities. That what they represented to them was a break from the past, which was disorder, chaos, disrespect for the rule of law, crimes with impunity. The tribunals then were meant to represent a start where the rule of law would be respected, where human rights would flourish, where democracy would be an ideal that was respected, and that they could have a voice and a participation in the process. So with this model of outreach then, outreach was the way to realize that transformative ideal that they were talking about. That outreach would be the way that people would shift from that moment of chaos to that moment of order. So at the end of the workshop, there was certainly no agreement on these three different views of outreach that seemed to emerge from that, but it certainly did make for good dinner time conversation in the end. But what Eric and I want to explore is that we're hoping to come to a better understanding of what it is that we do when we do outreach, why it's important, and to try and use the report that we're going to generate to close the gap between the lofty ideals that we find from states when they set up these tribunals, that it's going to promote peace, security, accountability for victims, and their actual willingness to be able to fund them, and particularly fund the outreach components of them. And I realize I've completely lost these. I want to leave us actually now by taking us back to where we started. So while I was in Sierra Leone actually a month ago, one of the things I did was go out to an amputee camp. So this was about 20 miles outside of Freetown, the capital. It was where a number of people lived who actually had their limbs cut off, which was a signature crime of the rebels actually during the Sierra Leonean War. Mr. Jesu Jakar was one of the person that I was going out to see. And he talked to me about outreach, and one of the things that he spoke to me about, and which was very powerful for me, was that the outreach section had actually taken him over to The Hague a few months before so that he could see the trial of Charles Taylor. And he said he was sitting in the courtroom in The Hague at one stage, and Charles Taylor looked over at him and looked straight at him sitting in the public gallery. And Mr. Jakar just raised up both of his arms. You know, he's cut off from, his hands are both cut off, and showed Charles Taylor what the rebels he allegedly controlled had done to him, that this was the consequences of their crime. And he said Charles Taylor just looked away and he couldn't acknowledge him and he didn't look at him again in the public gallery. But for Mr. Jakar, that was a very important moment, because just in that moment, he'd been able to level the playing field between someone very, very powerful and someone who'd been horribly victimized, and be able to confront them about the crime in a safe way. And of course, not every person, not every victim will get that dramatic moment where they'll be able to confront someone in safety. But to us, the more that we can encourage investment in outreach and ensure that people have the opportunity to engage with these trials in a meaningful way, then the more that they will know and the more meaningful it will be to have these accountability mechanisms conducted in their name. And now with that, I'll hand us over to Eric, actually, and we can maybe take some questions after Eric's finished.
Thank you, Tracy. And thank you all for coming. First of all, I want to thank, is that too loud? Sounds rather loud to me. Okay. First of all, I want to thank the fellowship program and Lenny and Steve and Lisena and Bibasha. This has been a great year. In fact, I've extended it a month. I've been enjoying myself so much. What I'll talk about today, or what I've really been doing in my research over the year, besides being in perpetual jet lag, is trying to look at how courts, and this is an area I've been interested in for years, how courts how they deal with witnesses, how they deal with victims, how, in terms of outreach, as Tracy has mentioned, how they communicate what they're doing to these communities. And I think one of the things we have to understand is that we always think in a domestic model. You know, courts here deal with one accused, usually three or four crimes or one crime. It's very small. These, we're talking tens and thousands of people. So it is a whole new terrain for the international justice community. And what we're trying to do in looking at outreach and victim participation is trying to understand what's going on here. So that's what I've been doing this year. And I just mentioned I've been twice to Cambodia. I spent 6 weeks there and worked on two Lehrer NewsHour pieces. So I tried to combine my research and the fellowship with real time, you know, to actually bring in the media, because I wanted them to do a piece on the work of the NGOs there, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Then I was in Tanzania to interview people, the Rwanda court, in Kenya, again in Uganda. Tracy and I were there in northern Uganda doing research, and we also attended the ICC review conference. And then on to Croatia and Bosnia, and a few meetings in between there as well in Europe and the United States. The great thing is, too, from the fellowship, and I don't think I would have received it if I hadn't done this year, was that my colleague David Cohen and I at Berkeley just received a grant from the National Endowment of the Humanities to write a book on these topics that we've been researching for the last 3 years. So the next 2 years we're going to be not in airplanes, but buckled down to desks writing. So what I'm going to talk about is what we call victim participation, and it's going to take a little bit of background because it is, for those of us who live in common law countries, as opposed to civil law countries, it's kind of a difficult concept to wrap your brain around because it involves a different sort of method of legal investigation and prosecution. Before I start there, I'll do two points of background information. My center, the Human Rights Center at Berkeley, we've been conducting population-based surveys in all of the except for Sudan, because we couldn't gain access, it's too dangerous, but in all the countries where the ICC has opened investigations or where there are now hybrid tribunals, we do surveys of populations to find out what they think about these courts and how can the courts better function to meet the needs of victims in particular. And the things we found is the vast majority of people in these countries consider themselves victims. That's number one. Number two, though, people have experienced violence in different ways, and as a result of that have different priorities and may view the court in different ways. Some people don't want to even hear about the court. Others want to become as engaged as possible. And the importance of this survey work is to find out who in the population. So, for example, if you have a case in which you do, in the Bemba case with the ICC, where you have sex crimes as part of the charge sheet, well, then you better find out if women have access to radios. And we found very low access to radios. So that tells the outreach office they can do more. They can do listenings. They can get radios to people. They can work to improve that outreach possibility. Then, historically, when we think of victims who come and testify before international criminal tribunals, we know very little. First of all, in Nuremberg and Tokyo, the aim of those trials and the subsequent trials that took place in both Asia and in formerly occupied Europe were really focused on the governments themselves. The 22 Nazi leaders who were brought to trial, Prosecutor Jackson made, the Justice Jackson, made the determination that he wasn't going to have a lot of victims on the stand. They had enough documentary evidence. They didn't need to bring in victims. He was actually nervous about what victims might say. So, in fact, the focus was more on documentary evidence and less on victims. The only real studies that have taken place of victim witnesses who testified are, I guess, the study I did of 64 witnesses, victims who testified at the Yugoslavia tribunal. There's also been a new study published in 2009 looking at women who testified in the rape trials, but primarily at Foča, which is a very interesting report. There's been a study done in Sierra Leone, and then the recent study that I'll talk about a little bit today in Cambodia. And why? One of the things, for me, someone who started out in the human rights movement back in the late 70s, that you'd seen is this juggernaut of international criminal justice. I mean, the way it took off from literally Argentina forward, was quite staggering. But a lot of times, and I did this as well as I think many of my colleagues in the human rights community, we made claims about justice or what justice did to victims without having any empirical evidence to support what we said. And some of these claims are when you testify, it's a cathartic experience, or that this will resolve, bring reconciliation, quite frankly, a word I think that should be banned from the lexicon. But we did, we sort of projected this idea, and it was a way, you know, when you're an advocate, you valorize the fact that trials will mean certain things for victims. And we found in our research over the years that it's much more complex than that. So let's look at victim participation. And first of all, just a little bit of background. In terms of common law and civil law, in the United States, wherever you know the crown of England shone, usually ended up with a common law system. And a common law system like we have here is very adversarial. The judge acts essentially as a referee. You have prosecution and defense. Each of them bring their witnesses. You spar it out in court. There is either a jury and a judgment is made. In the civil law tradition, which exists through continental Europe into Latin America, certain parts of Africa, Francophone African or Belgian protectorates and so on, is one in which it's an inquisitorial process, really coming from the Inquisition of the Roman Catholic Church, and that is that one or three, a set of judges sit and they develop a case and a dossier. And so they allow prosecution to come forward in the investigative phase with their documentation. They allow defense to come forward, and they allow victims to come forward. And victims actually have their own, so victims of the specified crimes, the alleged crimes. And those victims have their own representation, and their lawyers are there. Then when it goes to the trial phase, a certain number of those victim participants, or what are called partie civile, will actually testify in court. Now, it's different in different countries, but it's important that what you see with the civil law tradition is that the victim participants, or the civil parties, have essentially the same rights, not to the letter, but the same rights as the prosecution and defense. That means their lawyers can actually question the fact that the prosecutor hasn't brought certain charges. They are also there because they can direct questions to the accused during trial through the judges. And they're there if the crimes are proven, or then they would receive reparations if in fact they're reparations. So you have two different systems. So what's happened in recent years, you've seen in war crimes trials, there have been in Serbia, there have been some civil party participation or victim participation, Colombia, and then in universal jurisdiction cases in Belgium and Rwanda, and in the Netherlands as well. But the three main cases, and these are national trial war crimes trials, not international, as are the ones I mentioned earlier, have been in France. And those have been in the late 1980s and early 1990s. And those were Klaus Barbie, who was the head of Gestapo in Lyon during World War II, and Paul Touvier, who was the leader of Vichy-run paramilitary group, and Maurice Papon, who sent 1,690 Jews to concentration camps. So in those trials, there were hundreds of civil parties, and many of them had dozens of lawyers who were representing them in the trials. The interesting thing in the Barbie case is the definition that was accepted for victim defined victims as not only someone who'd suffered direct or indirect injury because of the acts of the accused, but also were those who were in the resistance, who in some ways fought against it. I mean, it was a very liberal definition of what a victim meant. So why now do we have it primarily at the International Criminal Court victim participation, and at the Cambodian court? And I really, in the research have come, I'm publishing this with two colleagues, Michelle Balthazard and Alexa Koenig. We've really looked, and we think there's four reasons that you've seen this movement for victim participation. One is this juggernaut, this incredible development of the human rights movement across the world, particularly from beginning really in Argentina in the 1980s, Eastern Europe, Philippines, where the human rights movement took off. But also since the 1960s, in common law countries like the United States, there's been a movement for victims' rights. For example, now anyone in a federal case in the United States, if you're a witness, you receive a card that spell out your four or five rights. Now that doesn't mean you get to participate in the trial any differently. You're still a witness, but it does tell you that the court will tell you when the judgment is going to be announced. The court will notify you when there's any, the dates of the hearings and so on. So these things have become embodied in the common law system in many countries. The second is there have been a lot of UN initiatives on saying that reparations are a right that victims should have and so on. Thirdly, there have been a case law development in treaty-based human rights courts, particularly in the European Court, which has more and more recognized that victims should have a participatory role. And fourthly, I think rightly or wrongly, I actually think wrongly, but I think a lot of criticism has been directed at the ICTY, the Yugoslavia Court, and the Rwanda Court, because their victims only participated as witnesses. And people argued and criticized those courts that they were simply, these victim witnesses were just there as instruments of the court to supply, describe facts, but in fact they weren't beneficiaries of the justice because neither of these courts had a reparations program. Interestingly, in our research, though, just as an aside, and I'd love somebody to do this, really an effective empirical study on this, is in our research in this time I spent, many people didn't really complain about getting reparations or not, even though we've sort of valorized the fact that there is a need for reparation. So what are the pros and cons of this civil party victim participation? The pros that people argue is one that having victim participation in the courtroom beyond being a witness restores dignity. Secondly, it contributes to healing and reparation for the suffering of victims, and it can bring to light facts that would not otherwise emerge in a trial. There is some truth in the Cambodian court to the third. When you hear the victim participants, the civil parties there, I mean, one would have to ask the judges, but most observers would say they did bring an understanding of the suffering that you wouldn't have gotten just from the victim witness. But the arguments against victim participation are, one, that it always has the potential to run roughshod over the defendant's rights to a fair trial. That, in fact, the defendant is facing not only the prosecution, but civil parties and their lawyers who could form an extension of the prosecution. So you have multiple prosecutions. Secondly, it can prolong proceedings and increasing the cost of prosecution. It can hinder the prosecutor's ability to conduct a focused investigation. This has been a problem at ICC where you can have the victim participant lawyers challenging the prosecutor for not having brought certain charges, and the prosecutor has to go back and do added investigation if the judges uphold that claim. And it provides legal recognition to certain victims and not others, thereby limiting any access to justice. So what that means is, through these victim participation programs, take Eastern Congo for example, those victims can only participate if they have been injured because of the stated crimes, the elements of the crime. So if it's only child soldiers, then your victim participants are going to be child soldiers. But rape victims aren't going to participate. Or you have a large group of people who just aren't going to have that access to the court. So there is an inequity there as well. So what's happened, the reason we have victim participation at the International Criminal Court is largely because of the French. They lobbied hard to include victim participation. And it was somewhat interesting. I've interviewed people who were there during the discussions of the Rome Statute, that a lot of the common law people were there just sort of pulled back and really didn't know how to deal with this question of victim participation. But anyway, it got into the statute and is a part of the process, and that means that those who are accepted as victim participants can receive reparations. However, most of those who are accepted as victim participants through the application process, the vast majority, will never ever set foot in the courtroom. Their lawyers will, but they won't. And so far, Tracy and I were discussing this earlier today, we believe, and anybody knows differently, that now there have been 4 victim participants that have actually appeared in a trial, while there are hundreds or the dozens of others who've been accepted. So that's a difference. Now in Cambodia, the civil party system that exists there, victim participation, but called civil party, comes out of the French law tradition in Cambodia. And it was brought not through the statute but through the article. And so what I did during November and December with my colleagues, we interviewed, well, we'll step back a bit. Of the victim participants accepted for the first trial, which is the trial of Doik, which just ended with a verdict, Doik was the commander of Tuolsang Prison, where nearly 14,000 people were tortured and later executed. And Doik, in the Doik trial, 90 civil parties were accepted. Out of those 90, only 22 testified, were accepted to testify. We interviewed 21 of the 22. The 22nd one was a woman who was in hospital and we didn't want to disturb her. So we interviewed them about this process of being a civil party. 4 of those 22 had survived Tuolsang prison. There were only really about 11 survivors from Tuolsang. It's believed there may be more, but. And the others are people who lost relatives at Tuolsang. Now, we then interviewed these people after they had testified. And when they testified, they don't testify under oath. They are there as a party, so they're recognized that they don't need to testify like a witness. So what in our interviews, and I won't tell, we're still working on the interviews and going through the data, but I'd like to tell you one of the bright sides that we saw in the involvement of these civil parties. In one of the cases, there was a man by the name of Nephali who had lost his brother at Tuolsang, and he came to Phnom Penh. He testified and told his story of the loss of his brother and so on, and at the end of his testimony, he asked the judge if he could show a photograph, the presiding judge, if he could show a photograph of his brother. And he takes out the photograph, and the judge says he can, and he holds it up, and the accused sits almost where Tracy is. I mean, you could really reach over and touch Doik here. And he shows the photograph to Doik, and he says, when my brother went into Tuolsang prison, he was blindfolded. But his blindfold was taken off, as we know, with prisoners when they photographed them. And so the blindfold was put on, but he never saw he never saw the accused, the person responsible for his torture and his death. And now I want him to be able to see the accused, and I want the accused to see him and recognize him as a human being. And now I want to turn the photograph and I want to show to the prosecutor that there's the defense is sitting here, the judges are sitting here, and the prosecution is sitting here, and that my brother is receiving justice. So you can see him and he can see you. And then he turns to the photograph and he actually looks at it and he addresses his brother and he says, and now I can tell you, my brother, that that I will never find your remains. And keep in mind, in Buddhist culture, burial remains is extremely important. Setting pyres and doing proper ceremonies for the dead is extremely important. But now that I've brought you into the courtroom and you've seen justice, I hope that you will be reborn again. So shortly after that, my colleagues and I traveled up to his farm, where we interviewed everyone throughout Cambodia. And we met his wife and his daughter, and he took us around to the back of his house where they'd put the photograph up and created a shrine for him. And for him, this was the most meaningful experience of his life, next to marrying his wife, who was sitting there, so he had to say that. But anyway, the point is, this was remarkable. And it was remarkable because you don't see moments like this in international criminal justice, because judges don't like you, witnesses, to move away from the facts. So there was a sort of a crossing of culture and justice at that moment. Another thing happened that the judges allowed, and that was this organization called the Trans Psychosocial Organization, TPO, was allowed to sit with the civil parties when they, and if they were needed, to sit by the while they testified. And this was important because people became very distraught retelling their stories. And also, once they had all testified, they went out to Chunek, which is the killing field that's near Tulsalan. People were taken, and they held a Buddhist ceremony there. And everybody had their folders, and when I would interview people, they always brought out their folders with the photographs and so on. So there was something here that was important for these people. Now, the dark side, or the dimmer side, let's say, of that, is that after the verdict was read, it was decreased from 35 to 19 years. Many of the civil parties were very upset. Secondly, they didn't like the low sentence. Also, the judges rejected 24 of the 90 civil parties, of which four of those had testified, for these were people who we had actually interviewed. And they were upset, and they weren't upset just, now you had a collective. You'd empowered these people. They have their victims association, and they were very upset that these 24 were rejected. Hopefully, in the next trial, they're not going to do this at the end, because you set up these people, you know, and then you're telling them they've been rejected. Rejected means that the judges considered in the end that they had not suffered a direct or indirect injury as the result of the crimes committed now, because they were accepted of the accused. Simply that, one is they don't get listed as having been a civil party. Secondly, they wouldn't get access to reparations, which they really won't anyway, because they're social and moral. But it's psychological. And that's why, because the idea is you've now gained an identity. What you saw was so many of those who testified. Repeatedly, they talked about the fact that their loved one was in the courtroom with them. They'd had an identity with the court and so on. And now, post facto, when it should have been sorted out earlier. So anyway, I don't want to go on much longer so we can ask some questions. So what, one of the things is, I think we can say from the Cambodia example, we don't know it at the ICC, but it can be a positive experience so long as those who participate see it as a safe, respectful, and a dignified experience. Secondly, it's not clear that in the case two that civil party participants are going to be as happy as they were in case one, even though it's a mixed picture. And the reason for this, and it's one that was really quite illuminating for me in all of these years of doing this research, is that what you had in case one was a prison, a single individual. It's a defined crime scene. Most of these people, for the last 30 years, have been questing, coming to the prison to find the photographs, to find the documents. And when they're in the courtroom, they finally have this chance, which is a little bit what Tracy was saying earlier, and I found with victim witnesses before, is the transference of power from them back to me, because they were able to actually ask, where was my brother buried? Where did you kill him? Why did you do this? So this confrontational aspect was there. In case two, which is going to deal with the leaders of the Khmer Rouge, it's going to be much more abstract. These leaders were not down, you know, in charge of one prison. So I don't know how well that's going to work out. The one thing that has to be said is the non-governmental organizations did a terrific job of going out, and is something we have learned, is that they can play a role in outreach and also in bringing in victims. If it hadn't been for the NGOs, this court would have deeply failed on both aspects. But there needs to be clear procedures from the beginning, and, you know, how to handle these victim participant civil parties. And I really urge, and I think we need to really drop this romantic rhetoric about what trials mean for victims. It's a very complicated process. And with that, I'd love to make a suggestion. I don't know if it's to Justice Initiative or to the International Center of Transitional Justice, but like the outreach meeting we held in Salzburg, where we were able to bring all these participants from the courts together, would be, if it would be possible, to do the same for victim participation, is to really come together and bring together the actual practitioners and to talk about what is this process, because I think we're going to have some difficult times ahead with the International Criminal Court if we don't look seriously at this issue. Thanks.
That's perfect timing. We've now got half an hour for questions, actually. So, Abby. I didn't think you were taking me seriously when I said you had to ask questions.
Oh. I'm Abby Schwartz with the Southeast Asia Initiative. I really appreciated your analysis of the victim participation in the KRT. Really summed it up very nicely, I think. And I appreciate that you mentioned TPO, because I know that this is a particular pet issue of mine, as Tracy knows. One of the concerns that if, as you say, we need to think about outreach in maybe a different way, rather than just simply bringing justice, it's also about an opportunity for community or individual empowerment and maybe some reconciliation, then I think that there's even more incentive than there already is to provide some sort of psychological support if you're going to ask people to really delve into painful histories and try and come out on a more positive note. But in so many countries that are war-torn, there just aren't any available services. In Cambodia, there are, 22, 23 licensed mental health professionals, so serving a population of 12 million, 13 million. I could have those numbers wrong. And I just wonder if this is something that you've thought about in your research and how you think it could be addressed.
Mm-hmm. Can I go for it? Well, first of all, in my presentation, and I think in Tracy's too, but I'll just speak to the victim participation. I'm not pro or con. I'm still at a point. In fact, I am skeptical. Maybe it's the common law genes in me, but that it may work in some situations and others it doesn't work, and that's why it's important to study and understand the process. It's interesting because there is an article that came out recently in the Human Rights Quarterly, which did a bit of what's called a meta-analysis that looked at all of the studies, and they're not very many, but no one knows. There's no firm saying that the victims testifying is re-traumatizing or not. So we need to understand that's not a decided fact. But what I think is, and the resilience that people often come out of it also has to be taken in consideration. I think the point that needs to be made about outreach is, when we look, say, in Cambodia, when we look at the numbers, that there was tremendous, up to 80% or more, of people born before and after the Khmer Rouge wanted the court and were interested in it, wanted to learn more about it. When we did our survey in Central African Republic, where there are indictees of the ICC, we found over 90% of people were interested and wanted to know. So I guess For me, courts are limited. I don't think courts should be social engineering institutions. I believe they have to serve justice first, but we can find ways to build around them systems as long as they're not too expensive. And there's a problem here. The International Criminal Court is on a zero freeze, in terms of hires and so on. I mean, they may increase a few, but you take on more and more cases, it's going to be difficult. But I do think there are ways in which they can better outreach to communities. I don't know if I'm answering the psychological question, but I don't think in case two and the other cases there'll still be a limit to the number who actually testify.
I'm talking a little bit more about the outreach activities, because you have all these NGOs that, I apologize, I didn't make this clear.
Yeah.
I was trying to keep my question short. But you have all these NGOs going out and doing all this really in-depth kind of community dialogues and interview. Prior to case 001, you know, they were doing investigations, and now you have communities that are organizations that are bringing communities to Chew and Egg and Tool Slang, and you know, putting people in who suffered trauma into potentially re-traumatizing scenarios. And there aren't the available psychological like it would be great if a representative from TPO and what's the other one? There's one other one in Cambodia. Were able to participate in all these community outreach activities, but they can't because there aren't enough of them. So I guess I feel like these outreach activities have such an opportunity to bring reconciliation to a community, but I also think that sometimes there's the danger that they could reignite some old particularly in communities where you have people from both sides of a conflict or...
Yeah.
No, I think, Abby, that's an excellent question.
Yeah.
I think part of the challenge is that outreach is just so new and really understudied, and people think it's very important to do, but we don't quite know how to do it properly yet. And, you know, if we keep with Cambodia, for example, so we ran a little outreach project ourselves back 2006, and I would go out with them to the countryside, and I was really struck there because, you know, the crimes that are being prosecuted, you know, as everyone knows, happened 30 years ago. And then after that, there was a real encouragement on the political level for people not to speak about it, to bury the past. And so the tribunal suddenly became this platform for people to be able to speak about what happened to them. And so we would screen our little videos, which I have to say were much better shot than mine. but it would really strike me that people wouldn't necessarily talk about what was in the videos, but they would come up and tell their own personal stories, and it could be to hundreds of people, you know, in their own community about what happened to them or what happened to their families. And I think, you know, Thierry Seng, who runs an NGO who would do these community forums, actually recognized the importance of you know, that psychological aspect, and she would have people, I think, from TPO there on hand, you know, so if people got overwhelmed by emotions, they could actually have an opportunity to speak. But I guess then the question, you know, might become too, if you've got 22 practitioners in the whole of the country, how used to people are, you know, how are people really used to being able to explore, you know, these psychological feelings in a way with you know, professionals to help them through this, and does the one-off really help them to be able to deal with that? And so, you know, it's a very, very tricky area, and it's hard, and I don't think anyone's really done any study about the impact of actually talking about, you know, experiences or whether this re-traumatizes people in the context of outreach that I know of.
No, and it's difficult. I mean, the one is, there is with torture victims, and there is, a lot of the studies, particularly out of Chile with torture victims, is the fact that the greatest thing a torture victim faces coming out, and this is what they, is trust, is rebuilding trust, because we all live with one another passing on the street that we're not going to hit each other. And when you come out, even trust your family because you've been through this abuse. Well, one of they believe very strongly is in essentially talk therapy. Testimony. So you retell the story and so on. And the way it's looked at, almost in psychoanalytic terms too, is there two speakers. There's the person, the listener is the one, I mean, two listeners. There's the one who you're telling the story to, and you're also telling it to yourself, because you're trying to remake order and remake order. So but we don't know what that means to these communities and so on. So it's a very real question. But then it could also come back to the fact just having the trials. Because people will watch the trials and see it and start talking about it even at home. And sometimes, just with some Holocaust survivors, parents didn't talk about it to their children. We know this happened in Cambodia, because the way you survived was to look inwards. And so a lot of those who survived did not talk about it with their children, and now they're having to do it. So we just don't know what's happened.
Hi, I'm Sandy Colliver. Hi, Eric. My question is, to what extent did you get a sense that having victim participation benefits communities? Do communities feel of victims feel more connected because there are the victims participating? And, you know, obviously part of my context for this is the civil lawsuits in the U.S. where you have two or three people who you hope are representing hundreds of thousands of Salvadorans or Guatemalans. Did you find anything that would suggest that there's more connection when there's victim participation?
So I think this is the point in which you anecdote, the plural of anecdote is data. So I can tell you anecdotes, but we don't know. I sat once in Rwanda with a women's organization where they were showing a clip of a rape victim testifying at the Rwanda tribunal, and it was so interesting to see the women saying, "Oh, Masur," that she was saying this. So there was a connection. Yet I don't think in Cambodia we could come out of our time spent there and say that because this person in this village went to testify, that necessarily his or her members of the community identified with him or saw it. And the thing that I think can be dangerous when you get into reparations is the fact, if you do see the awarding of individual reparations only to the civil parties, but not to other victims, the feeling can be, wait a minute, what's going on here? It's interesting at the International Criminal Court, because they have established a trust fund for victims. And this trust fund is empowered, it's semi-autonomous from the court, to give money in situation countries where there are already cases. And it gives in three areas. One is in physical rehabilitation, primarily physical reconstruction. So in northern Uganda, where people had their lips and their nose and their ears cut off, there's now a program where and Tracy and I visited the surgery there, where they're getting reconstructed. The second is primarily in psychosocial support for women and children, child soldiers and women who suffered sexual violence. And thirdly, material support, so even chickens and things like that. My feeling is the first two I can see, and I can't say empirically, but people would probably accept that people really suffered that way should be. But I don't know, when you give one affected community material reparations and another doesn't get it, what that means. So I think, it's still, we just don't know yet. But I think there are problems with reparations in that regard that could create jealousy.
Kung Lee, thank y'all. Mm-hmm. Just a question, I think it's just following up on the sort of question about the role of the NGOs and their own perception of what they're doing. Two parts to it, just whether, and this is going to be a vast generalization, of course, but whether they think of what they're doing as being an arm of the court when they do outreach, or whether they're working alongside and leveraging what's happening in the court to do more organizing, right? So whether they're sort of doing what they think they're doing, and then related to that, whether they are thinking in terms of victim participation, the individuals that are participating, or in terms of victim impact.
Yeah. To go back a little background, when the court was established, this was really justice on the cheap. So it was so poorly funded every year. Even now, the Cambodia courts, is it going to get the funding it needs and so on to continue? So what they did is they, in terms of outreach, they just farmed it out to the NGOs. And in some court, people were, my God, you just don't give it to NGOs, to do. It's a responsibility of the court. But quite frankly, in the end, it was the best thing to do, because the NGOs had their structure, they knew the culture, and they could get outreach to people. But I would say they felt that they wish they had greater support from the court and perhaps more funding from donors, but they did receive some, is that they preferred to be somewhat independent too. So I think they saw themselves as going out and doing this not as an extension of the court, because they also reserved the right for somebody else in another program office to criticize the court. So, and I think they accept, and they were, then what happens is in the post-trial phase, after people have testified, or, and this now what's happened is the court has taken on the outreach activities itself, finally. It's gotten funding largely from the German government, and the NGOs have had a sense of having the carpet pulled out from underneath them, and they're not, you know, there's no need for them anymore, and they're quite distressed about that. So it's just it's the problem of doing justice on the cheap, you know, and it happens with all of these courts. Is the poor orphan is the outreach, and I think a lot of that is because we come from court systems where we don't think of outreach. That's the role of the press, but you know, that's basically the situation. I don't know if you want to add.
No, I just wanted. She had a second question, which was victim impact.
Oh, you mean the follow-up by NGOs on victim
impact? Do they think of victim participation or victim impact? Is that right?
Right. Whether, I mean, this is, I think you answered part of it, but just whether, you know, if I'm an NGO that is really interested in victim participation, I'll do my work in a certain way. But if my role is to keep my eye on victim impact, then I'll do my role, you know, I'll do my work in a different way.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And how would you define victim impact?
Well, just one example is, you know, if we're talking about victim impact, it may be that the biggest impact is when the results, you know, when the results come out, you know, that's when your work really starts,
yeah.
Right?
Very
and
good.
It's like, you
Absolutely.
Know,
yeah.
you've now changed the ending of the story, and you can have you can leverage that into something pretty tremendous. Very
yeah.
different than
yeah.
getting people to court and
right.
preparing them.
Well, what Abby, the TPO, this organization, right after the verdict, they have a hotline, and they had people calling in, and they were so distraught by the low sentence, and the people had been rejected as civil parties. So this hotline was very important. So TPO, I think most of the NGOs kind of put it into TPO's bailiwick to handle that. But a lot of the NGOs did follow up, but they don't have the funding now. They can't continue doing this because the money has shifted towards the court. So really, their role was largely going out into communities and saying, you have a possibility to be a civil party. Here are the forms, sitting with the people, filling in the forms. And then a lot of those people didn't get accepted even in the beginning. So, you know, you've got rejection. And then it becomes, well, why? I'm a victim. Why was I rejected? And the NGOs just don't have the capacity to, you know, explain it to everyone. They tried the best they could. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Ben Batros, working up in the Justice Initiative, and I heard you mention a couple of times that, you know, the Cambodian court has been doing it on a shoestring, that the ICC's got a hiring freeze, and it made me wonder about the degree to which outreach is a question of expectation management on behalf of courts managing the expectations of the victim communities, and the follow-on from that being, to what extent is outreach a one-way process of the court giving information, managing expectations, you know, providing, trying to achieve an outcome in the victim community, and to what extent is it actually a two-way process where the court's trying to get feedback from the victims, or do you see that in your experience and from what you guys got out of the Salzburg workshop as only coming through the act of participation of those victims who participate as opposed to outreach to the entire community?
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends from court to court. In Sierra Leone, they actually have defendants' rights day, or they'll go out and have a day and say, we're going to talk about defendants' rights. So that victim communities understand that defendants do have rights, and explaining why these defendants have rights. What happened in the Sierra Leone court is this is what we heard. It was that in the beginning, many people were very upset because they weren't actually going after the youth. Not wouldn't say children, but the youth. because they are the ones in the communities who committed the crimes. Why were they just going after these 13 top leaders? And so the court had to go out and explain this, that we're only going after those most responsible. And it took a while for the communities to come round to understanding this. So and then in a situation like Cambodia, where you find very low faith in the national judicial system, how then are you going to expect people to take that quantum leap to trusting this international court? When in the end, actually, many people did say it's because it's an international court that they had more trust. And that's one of the reasons you do the baseline surveys to begin, is to find out what are people thinking throughout the country, and that you will find that different communities see it in different ways. The Acholi in northern Uganda may be more negative towards the court, but Joseph Kony is an Acholi. The children who abducted are Acholis, or the Lua, and other groups around it might be more pro the court. So you're going to have to readjust how you do your outreach, and it's a huge, huge task, and with very low funding.
No, I think those two questions are very important. One, I mean, the expectation management is across the board, there's going to have to be expectation management because you can never reach, I mean, no matter how many resources, it's going to be very difficult to reach everyone in affected populations. So there's always choices that I think are being made. But I think that the extent to which you have to manage expectations really, we've been finding, depends on the model that you employ. So, for example, at the ICC, there's security concerns because there's ongoing conflicts, for example, and so the ICC will not necessarily partner very easily with NGOs to get them to go out and do outreach in affected communities because they're worried about the protection aspect of having to have obligations to protect these NGOs if they get into trouble. And so they've had to very much target the affected population. So, for example, they're based in Kampala, but that's not their effect. So in Kampala being the capital of Uganda, for instance, but Kampala is not their target population. It's people up in the north where the LRA was most active. That's their target population. So that's where they do all their community work. They do very little in Kampala. So you have less people probably knowing in Kampala what's going on with the ICC than you might in the north. And when you compare that sort of model, for example, to the Sierra Leone model that I was talking about earlier, they have not only actual outreach officers stationed in every district, but then they have set up this small grants regime where they actually give grants to NGOs, and the NGOs go out and do the outreach themselves. So the Amputee Association, for example, does a lot of the outreach with the amputee populations, and women's groups do it with market women or with other women's groups that are usually marginalized. So there they can have a greater reach, but regardless, you're still going to have to manage expectations, I think.
Yeah, I when I was talking about managing expectations, I wasn't talking about how much outreach you're doing. I was talking about whether or not, and it was this issue of just the 13 as opposed to the foot soldiers, managing the population's expectations of what the court is going to do. And therefore, especially given that that's inherently a function of the budget that the courts are given, to what extent, if you're seeing outreach as partly a way of getting feedback from communities, should that feedback only be going to the court, or should one of the functions of outreach be a way for victims to communicate with the states who are essentially defining the scope of the court's work?
Yeah. No, that's... No, I think that really goes to also the mandate and how the courts see their role within communities as well. So, for example, if you take the transformational ideal that I was talking about before, when you go and speak to the Special Court for Sierra Leone Outreach, they see their role as being the creation of legacy through outreach so that they can ensure that the population knows about their rights, they know about the rule of law, they know what's a crime, they know what the expectations are, and at the same time engaging the legal community, so to build up the skills and the knowledge of the crimes in the hope that then there will will be some domestic capacity to be able to take forward prosecutions beyond that tiny little number that the court itself is able to prosecute. So they do see it as, you know, on the one hand, outreach is a way of building political will amongst the community to demand more from their own state in terms of bringing crimes, and also building the capacity of the national legal community as well to be able to push that forward also. But not all courts think that way.
And by the sounds of things, not a vehicle for the community to encourage states to provide funding for the court to do more.
Oh. Yeah, well, the... No, I was going to say, look, the one thing... One of the things we need to understand, and we haven't done very well, we're getting more, is, and I go to a phrase which is, all memories are local. When you suffer war crime or trauma, it's you in your village, in your hut, in your wherever you are, and that you remember that, and it's often extended to the person who, or the paramilitary group that came in. You go after somebody higher up, that's fine, but that doesn't necessarily translate. And we found this cross surveys everywhere that people still do not like the fact that there are war criminals that they can in their communities and so on. When you have international criminal court is not going to deal with the lower level, and that's a key problem. Now, the way it's of course, is the complementarity is that if the ICC becomes involved, then it's the process of having national court system build up to handle those crimes. But justice is a thing that's always about to happen. It's not going to happen, you know, for years and years and years, the court system. So outreach is constantly kind of swimming upstream. There's no question. And I think Tracy would agree, we believe that the courts exist, and if you don't have outreach, you're going to be in a worse situation than if you do. But it's not saying that that's the panacea by any means. It's just too deep a problem.
And the last and very excited question.
I just wanted, I'm Noy, by the way, and Northrop Cow, another fellow. I just wanted to ask a question related to the previous discussion, which is, you know, people speak very often about Cambodia's culture of impunity. And I'm interested in hearing about the ways in which victims may or may have not have addressed the issue not of the foot soldiers who are not being indicted in these courts, but the higher-ups in the current Cambodian government who have been involved in KR activities, and whether the scope of the trial is something that is disappointing to them or not, considering the current state of the miscarriage of injustice in terms of assassinations of union leaders and acid attacks and various other forms of judicial meddling and corruption, and if there's been any kind of talk about that. Tracy, you were speaking about the transformative aspect of the Sierra Leone trials, and I'm interested in hearing if there's any discussion of that whatsoever in the Cambodian context.
Maybe I can put my monitor hat on for a moment. So we monitor the Cambodia trials, and I'd worked a lot on that until the last year or so. Where to start? So I think when the Doik trial came, you know, he was the lower level, he didn't have any political, you know, benefactors that would look after him, really. You know, that was one thing to go forward. I think for us as monitors, the next, you know, and then the second trial that's due to go forward were people who were seen as enemies or had fallen out from the current government, and so it was understandable they would be brought to trial and it would be okay for it to go forward. The real issue came for us in terms of cases 3 and 4, who would be brought to trial beyond those who were the expected ones, right? And we thought that this would be a real test of, one, the independence of the tribunal itself. Would it be able to bear this in the light of the big concerns about political interference more generally that exist in the Cambodian judicial context? And two, would it have some sort of demonstration effect? Would it open the cracks or the doors to be able to enable people in Cambodia to see, actually, justice against people that are not protected by higher up people is actually possible, and we've seen it happen in this trial. I think increasingly, and it's still an open story, we haven't finished the story yet, but I think the Cambodia Tribunal has perhaps showed, at least at this point, the limitations of that demonstration effect that these tribunals can have. I mean, we're not over yet. We haven't got to cases three and four, but the way that it has been discussed is, you know, that we may actually never get there to three and four. It's very hard. I think there were hopes that maybe there might provide cracks in the justice system in Cambodia to provide, you know, to counter this culture of impunity that you're talking about. But also at the same time, when you speak to people who have dealt with the Cambodian justice system for a long time, they say, that's totally a pipe dream you monitored. It was never going to be able to do that. And this is, you know, so perhaps just in Cambodia, it's a particularly difficult, hard case, and maybe we can't have that expectation of what these trials can achieve in that context.
Even looking from the issue of who is funding the tribunal and the interplay of the different powers that lend its support, financial and otherwise, to the rise of the KR and their continued legitimization, I find the whole process a bit ironic.
Yeah. Well. Remember, courts are not social engineering institutions.
Yeah.
It's not going to change, in my view, to hold your breath, because it's not going to change the national judicial system. There are, the television program about the court has become very popular, and it's being watched, and so people are discussing it. But it's all in measures. It's not so that it's going to come in and have some transformative role. I don't think it's going to happen. And the fact that, you know, there still has never been open discussion about the corruption charges and the political interference and so on, whether that is something that weighs on the minds of the average Cambodian is another question, because people, you know, focus. But so it has had some benefits, but I don't see it being transformative in that process. It's going to take a lot more and a lot more investment. I mean, the court couldn't fund itself. Yeah.
And I think the donors is a very good point. I mean, if you take a step back and look at the donors generally in Cambodia, and you look at the amount of investment, for example, China is putting in now, that doesn't want to have any, that doesn't interfere in other states' domestic processes, and the battle that they are having with Japan in terms of influence there, then, you know, I think China's contribution, when I looked a couple of years ago, I think all of the donors put together were $600 million or something dollars, and that was less than what China was contributing to Cambodia. So in terms of leverage that other donors who may be interested in justice reform can actually have over the government when they know they've got this steady support, you know, by this very powerful and donor is very limited, and we've been seeing that over the past few years. You know, there are some small changes that you can see being made, but in terms of a larger impact on the domestic system, it's just very difficult in that broader context to be able to leverage change through donors. Okay, I think we're out of time now, but thank you so much for staying through to the end. you're truly rallying to the cause here, but I'm really pleased you came along, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.